Well, I want to pick right back up where we left off from last week, last Sunday night. And if you were here, it was a bit of a topical message. And that is, we're just addressing some important matters in our culture and church today. And in fact, we want to think biblically, as we said, about everything that we are seeing. You can see the title of it was Thinking Biblically About Today's Culture. And I guess you can include in some of the things I want to say tonight, Thinking Biblically About Today's Culture and Today's Church. Because tragically, the church has mimicked the culture in many, many respects. And so, if you were here last week, I started giving you a list. I think I said I had about 15. And we'll just see how far we get. I think I only got up to 5. Last week, and we're really not in any kind of rush to get through these. I think it's very important we all understand this, but I said as a pastor, as an elder, we're also seen as watchmen. That is to say, we're watching society as a whole, even worldwide events, and as a result, I'm just burdened to give you a biblical perspective and a theological evaluation, not just on one particular issue, and we could do that, but really on the culture as a whole, as a church on the whole. And if you're like me and you're watching it and you are equally burdened, you may ask yourself, how did we get to this point? How did we get to this point? Why is our culture, why is our church, even much of Western society, seem to be crumbling at a rapid pace? We all watch the TV, we see the rioting, we see the looting, we see and hear, rather, the lies after lies after lies. And some of you might be looking for answers, and we all need some answers to this. And we need to be reminded that there is something far more evil going on than what we are watching on television. Of course, we're waging war on a number of different fronts, whether it be abortion, marriage, gender, sexuality, social justice, and the list goes on and on and on. But you need to understand that those things are ultimately not the issue. That's just on the surface, as it were. Behind them all is something much more sinister, darker, and deadlier. And as I said, we all need to understand that. And so what I want to give you is just my own prophetic thoughts. I just, as I said, grabbed my thinking pad, sat on my thinking chair, and some of the younger ones might know what I'm alluding to when I say that. But just sat down on the chair and just started brainstorming and just started thinking what's going on and thinking it through a biblical lens. And so we began last week with the first, and really is the beginning one. Everything else is not really in any particular order, but this is needs to come out first, and that is, and I just want to review those few before we move on, is that we're not surprised or should not be surprised by what is happening today. We need to know that. Remember, Peter says, you know, it's no strange thing that these things are happening to you. We live in a world. We are all pilgrims. We live in a world. And in this life, we will have what? Tribulations. We are going to have trouble. This is a cursed world. But when it comes to the church, in particular, we're not surprised either. Remember, I gave you the text of 2 Timothy 3:1, where Paul tells Timothy, but realize this, that in the last days, and when are the last days? Well, the last days were really inaugurated when Christ ascended to heaven. We're in the last days ever since then. And he says, in those last days, difficult times will come. Perilous times, depending on what translation you have. Dangerous seasons is probably even a better translation, because the word times there is the Greek word kairos. Not chronos in the sense of chronological time, but kairos in the sense of epochs or seasons. And so dangerous seasons, fierce, violent, even savage seasons, or even periods, movements, whatever word you want to use. But the point is that there's going to be seasons, waves of seasons that are going to come and attack the church. And they're going to be fierce, and they're going to be violent. They're going to be dangerous, and they're going to be frightening. And you can look back at church history, and you can see them all. All the schisms, and spasms that have come to the church, they've come to attack the church. And it's in these last days that will be savage, when men will cast off all moral restraint in society begins to disintegrate. And we are seeing that right before our very eyes. And Paul says, realize this. Mark it. Know it. Do not be surprised. The church and the gospel, in a very real sense, is at threat. And that's why we fight. We're soldiers. We wage war, as it were. So that's the first thing I said. And again, I don't think we need to say any more than just reviewing that. That we are facing today as a church, what we are facing today as a church, rather, is not surprising. We are in the midst of another dangerous period. Secondly, then, we said that not only that, we are watching the heart of man manifesting its true nature. If you want a good introduction into the doctrine of man, the theology of man, anthropology as it's called in theology, then just turn your TV on and watch it. The myth of the goodness of man, that's been busted. Man is not good. And as I said, we are really seeing the heart of man at work today. And I mentioned to you that the reason is seems to be getting worse and worse is because the restraints, the moral restraints that God himself has placed in society, as a society, have knocked each one of them away. So he is then now free to do whatever he wants. And we said those moral restraints, just to remind you. The first is his conscience, right? God has put in the conscience of every man his law, which is in his heart. And so made in the image of God, he has an understanding that that there is a right thing, right way, and there's a wrong way of doing things. There is a law there that is used by his conscience to either accuse or excuse. But when you are told to ignore your conscience, or you're told to suppress your conscience, or you're told to sear your conscience, well, that restraint is gone. And then there's no more pang in the conscience. You just do whatever you want to do. And we've had 30, 40 years of psychology to tell us that. And then after that, then you have what? You have the after the conscience, you have the government, right? You have government and the police, for that matter, that tells you what is right and what is wrong. But when you have people in government that don't know what is right and wrong, and then again allows you to do whatever you want, then what you get is what you get today. That restraint has been removed. And the people that, and you hear it, defund the police, defund the police. Again, with the police gone, with the government gone, that restraint is gone. Man does whatever he wants to do. So the conscience is gone. The government is crumbling. And then, of course, the family is crumbling. And that would be the third restraint. God has put into society the family. The family where there's, and by family, we have to say this today, where there's a mother and there's a father. There's a male and a female in the family. And that was by God's design, with the father and the mother complementing each other in the upbringing of children and nurturing them in the Lord, or just nurturing them, teaching them self-control. That's no longer there. And then the last frontier, as it were, in terms of moral restraint, of course, is the church. The church. The church is the salt. The church is the light. But the church now doesn't even know what to do. They don't understand what it is to be salt. They don't understand what it means to be light. It's very much like the world, and so there is no restraints anymore, so to speak. They're all been, at best, lessened, and that's why you have the mess that we have. Man, with his nature, with the way his heart is, with all the restraints gone, it's manifesting its evil wickedness, and that's what you're watching. We looked at a number of texts. Let me just give one to you just to remind you that that the heart, that is the mind, this is Jeremiah 17:9, is more deceitful. The deceitful there has the idea of crafty or treacherous. It's more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick. That is to say, it's diseased and incurable. And the question comes, well, who can understand it? I mean, you can't understand yourself if you're that sick. And then the text follows up by saying, but it's the Lord who examines the heart. The Lord knows. And that's why when you want wisdom, you don't seek your own wisdom. You don't seek your own heart, but you seek and ask God for counsel, right? What does the Proverbs say? Trust in the Lord with what? All your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your paths straight. That is to say, go to God. Go to God. When you search your own heart and you depend on your own heart, it's just nothing but a recipe for disaster. All of that to say is man's problem is not his lack of education. His problem is not his bad environment or his dire circumstances. At the heart of it is his heart. You understand that. That's the issue. That's the problem. He has a bad, sick, depraved heart. And as I said, we are watching it all in its sickness at the moment. He needs to be regenerated. He needs to be transformed. He needs a new heart. That's the solution. That's the solution. And the only way he gets a new heart is through the power of what? Of the gospel. And then that goes back to the church as being salt and light. And it's our responsibility to go out and preach the gospel so that God, in his grace and his sovereignty, can do that life, heart-changing work. And we could say a lot more on that, but I think you get the point. So let me just review point number three that we came up with. Here's a third thought. We live in a society that hates God. Now, I would be obviously, if the heart is evil and wicked and it's left to unchecked and without restraint to do whatever it wants to, well, what's going to come out is what's in there, and what it's in there is that he hates God. Again, that's what you would expect from people who have wicked hearts. Turn your Bibles to Romans 1. The text that Patea read earlier, Romans 1. Paul puts it this way in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That's very key that you understand what he means by that. This is the unbeliever that suppresses the truth. That is, man holds the truth down and squashes it. Some of you might have A.T. Robertson's Word Pictures of the New Testament. It's an old work, but it's still very valuable. On this text, A.T. Robinson says that the picture here is somebody who takes the truth, puts it in a box, closes the lid, and then sits on it. That's how much he hates the truth. Why does he suppress the truth? He hates the truth. Listen, ungodly and unrighteous men and women, the Apostle Paul says, are, and this is the present active participle, are continually, actively, willfully, deliberately restraining, hindering, and withholding the truth about God. And why is that? Because his heart is what? Is evil. Now, one of the things you may wonder about is, my grandmother, my lovely, dear old grandmother, she's not a Christian, but are you describing her? Well, yes, but let's nuance this a bit, that not everybody suppresses the truth the same. You understand that? Some suppress it a lot. And again, we look at our society, and there's a bulk of people who are suppressing it quite considerably. Some people that we might call quote-unquote moral, aren't as bad as they could be, they are suppressing the truth, but maybe they're not suppressing it as much as others. So there's levels of suppression, you could say. Hence why there's levels of evil, levels of wickedness. It is true that all suppress the truth, but some suppress the truth than others. Some suppress a little, some suppress a lot, but again, all suppress. This is the point Paul's making. Every unbeliever suppresses the truth. And the reason for that is, to a smaller or a larger degree, all believers hate God. You have to understand that. You have to understand that. That's why, some of you know this, when you engage in apologetics, when we engage in apologetics, we have an understanding that, and some of you guys will understand what I'm about to say, there is no neutrality. Do you understand that when I say that? There is no neutrality. That is to say, if you don't have an understanding of the doctrine of man, that his heart is wicked, that he suppresses the truth, you would assume that he's open to the gospel. You would assume that, you know, he's like the guy that puts on his, you know, his white lab coat, goes into the laboratory, and he's just wanting to see truth. He just wants to find out truth. And so he, you know, he experiments, and there is no bias. There is no bent. He's neutral. Well, that's not the case when it comes to spiritual matters. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 2 that he doesn't welcome the truth, right? He comes and the picture there is that he doesn't put a welcome mat out there for the truth. He's not interested in the truth. He hates the truth. He hates God. So again, there's no neutrality. And you need to understand that. You need to understand that the unbeliever that you're talking to across the table is someone who hates God, hates God's truth. He suppresses God's truth. Now, he might suppress it to one degree or another, but that's who he is. That's his nature. So again, when we talk about apologetics, we talk about ontologically. You know, I'm using big words here, but ontologically is the theory of what? Is the theory of being. The theory of being says that this person you're talking to, and Tony, you correct me if I'm wrong, but the theory of being, this person you're talking to is made in the image of God. And that's what you have in common with him. He is an image bearer. It's marred, but the image is still there. And so you talk to him as someone who's made in the image of God, who has a sense of God, the sense of deity. As Patea just read, he knows there is God. He knows there is a God. The evidence is overwhelming. So he's without excuse. So ontologically, you have that in common with him, but that's all. Because epistemologically, again, another big word, epistemology is a theory of knowledge. In terms of his worldview and my worldview, they're diametrically different, diametrically opposed. And so we're coming at different angles. He believes something. He has everything raised up against the knowledge of God. Remember Paul in 1 Corinthians 10? Everything raised up against the knowledge of God. And what does Paul say? We come in like a rescue mission, and we break down those fortresses. We break down those walls, and we take every thought captive to what? The obedience of Jesus Christ. We're on a rescue mission, right? And the rescue mission, when it comes to the sinner, the one who is rebelling against God, is that he's got this big old wall up there, and with God's help, because you're not going to break the wall down on your own wit and wisdom. You need the Spirit of God, but the Spirit of God uses what? How do you fight error? What's the only thing that's going to combat error? Truth. So you bring the truth, and with the truth, with the power of God, those walls come down, and you take that captive, the one that's behind that wall or that prison, that tomb, and you bring him out to what? The Lordship of Jesus Christ, so that every thought is captive to him. There is no neutrality. They have a different worldview. We have a different worldview. The only way that worldview is going to change is by bringing the truth to him. And in God's sovereign grace, if he is merciful, he will break those walls down. But that's the world we live in. That's the society we live in. We live in a society that hates God. And you need to know that. Number four. Much more we could say, but we got to keep moving here. Number four. Not only do they hate God, but we live in a society that hates God's law. Now that would be obvious, and I am stating the obvious, and perhaps this is a bit redundant, but let's just spell that for what it is. The word antinomian. Some of you know what that means. You need to have that word in your vocabulary. An antinomian is what? Well, there's two words there, anti, which means against, and nomos means law. An antinomian is someone who is against the law, that is God's law. By nature, man is an antinomian. He hates God, and he hates God's law. He wants to be autonomous. Autonomous is what? A law to himself. Wasn't that the issue in the garden? God said, don't eat. Man and woman says, well, I'm going to eat. I'm going to be a law to myself. That was the issue there. They wanted to be autonomous. Man wants to be autonomous. Turn in your Bible to Psalm 2 for a moment. There's a number of texts we could go to, but this is a clear text on the the hatred that man has for God and God's law. Look at Psalm 2. This is a messianic psalm. This is a psalm of David. And David says, why are the nations in an uproar? That is, why are they raging? Why are they angry? And the peoples, and the word peoples there, by the way, in the Hebrew, is warrior peoples. This is military language. And why are they, that is the peoples, these people, warrior peoples, why are they devising a vain thing? You might have plotting. The word actually is our word for meditating. That is, you have these nations, you have these kings of these nations, you have these warriors, peoples, and they're sitting around the table and they're scheming, plotting, and they're meditating, they're chewing over, they're planning. And what are they planning? Verse 2. Well, they're taking their stand. Again, that's battle language. They're taking their stand. And they're counseling together. So what are they planning? They're planning a coup against who? Against the Lord and against His anointed. So you can see here, this is where the hatred ultimately manifests itself. They hate God and they hate His anointed. Who's the anointed? Well, if you have a capital A there for anointed, then obviously it's referring to the anointed, which is Messiah, God's Son. And so, verse 3, what do they say? Let us tear their... Who's there? Well, again, the Lord and His anointed. Let us tear their fetters apart and let us cast away their cords from us. In other words, they bind us. They put us in bondage. They don't let us do what we want to do. This law of God is too constricting. I want to break free. Isn't there a song? I want to break free. Every time I hear that song, I think of this. And knowing who sung it, I'm not surprised if this was the inspiration behind it. But that's the theme song of society. I want to break free. They hate God's law. They hate God's rule over them. They want to be autonomous. God says homosexuality is a sin. Well, let us just break our chains He has put us in and free ourselves from that slavery. I don't care what the law of God says. I got to be true to my feelings. I've got to be true to my orientation. Isn't that what they say? As I said last time, the Bible isn't interested in your feelings, right? It's not interested in your feelings, what you think, how you feel, or how you want to be identified. It just says this is sin. This is right and this is wrong. This is why God is called righteous. Why? Because He is the author of what is right. The Bible only knows of obedience. And it knows of the consequences if you don't obey. So all of that to say, before we move on, is that we are living in a difficult season, very much like the days of Noah, where every intent of the hearts of man was only evil continually. Why? Because they hate God and they hate God's law. Let me give you a fifth point here. Number 5, we are experiencing as a society the judgment and wrath of God. You got that? Let me say that again. We are experiencing as a society the judgment and wrath of God. It's not we're going to experience, we are experiencing. You understand that, right? Again, if you're in Romans 1, look at verse 18. Romans 1, verse 18 says, for the wrath of God is revealed. And again, that's a present active participle, which you could translate, the wrath is presently revealed. It reminds me of John the Baptist in John 3:36, where John himself says, he who believes in the Son has eternal life, but he who does not obey the Son will not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. And there it's present as well. That is to say, if you believe in the Son, you have life. You have eternal life. But if you don't believe in the Son, you don't obey the Son, you don't have life. But what you do have is the wrath of God abiding on you. Not in the future, right now. The wrath of God is on you right now. And then here in Romans 1, it's the same thing. The wrath of God is presently revealed. And you say, well, what kind of wrath is that? And there are nuances to the word wrath. Sometimes it's referred to as eternal wrath, and we know that. We know when Christ comes back, and he's coming back, as we talked about in the catechism this morning, he's going to come back in judgment, and then they will, he will unleash his wrath, his eternal wrath. Then there you could say it's his eschatological wrath, and there's a cataclysmical wrath where, you know, sometimes we see, earthquakes and hurricanes and, you know, tsunamis and, you know, all kind of natural things, but under the providence of God, that is almost a shot across the bow. You know what I mean by that? It's every once in a while God just wants to say, hey, this is just a little bit of a snippet what's coming. Wake up. So there's eternal wrath, eschatological wrath, cataclysmic wrath, and there's also what we might call sowing and reaping wrath. God won't be mocked. What you sow, you will reap. So here you see wrath. The wrath of God is being revealed. Well, this wrath, what kind of wrath is this then? Well, you notice three times in this text, Paul says, God gave them over, right? God gave them over. God gave them over. God gave them over. You might have in your translation, he let them go. This is what we call the wrath of abandonment. You got that? The wrath of abandonment. Look at verse 24. Again, God gave them over. Verse 26, for this reason, God gave them over. Verse 28, in the middle of the verse, God gave them over. As I said, this is the wrath of abandonment. This is the giving them over or the letting go. Keep your finger here and go to Judges 16 for a moment, because I think this is a good illustration, an Old Testament illustration of what's going on here. In Judges 16, this is the story of Samson. And I'll just do this quick, because I think most of you know the story of Samson. Samson had a remarkable birth and a remarkable life, taking the Nazarite vow, but he was a bit of a philanderer, wasn't he? That's why his eyes were gouged out. I think that was judgment on him for being too much of a looker, as it were, at the Philistine women. And you guys know the story of how Delilah coaches him in and, you know, tell me your secret. Why are you so strong? And again, you know, the strength wasn't necessarily in his hair, but in fact, as we'll see, the strength was in the power of God, the Spirit of God that was upon him. But because he was a Nazarite vow, that was part of the deal. And so, Delilah gets him to tell the secret, and he says something, and then the Philistines are upon you. He goes up and does what he does with them. Second time around, he comes in, and Delilah said, come on, tell me what it is. What's the secret? Because, you know, she's being paid off by the Philistines to find out what the secret is. And again, he tells her something else, and he goes to sleep. And the Philistines are upon you, and he goes and does his thing. And finally, exasperated, Delilah keeps pestering him, and he says, it's my hair. It's my hair. If you cut my hair, then, yeah, my strength will be gone. And so we pick up the story there. In verse 19, then she lulled him to sleep on her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. And then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he awoke from his deep sleep. And notice what he says. I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free. Here we go again, Samson says. I'll just go out and do what I always do. But what's the next sentence? But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. He tested God. We tested God too much to the point where God says, I'm departing. I'm abandoning you. Not an eternal abandonment. We might call this a temporal abandonment. I think, by the way, this is a footnote. I think the Lord sometimes does that with us even to today. I think if you test the Lord, you indulge in that secret sin over and over and over again without much remorse, without much repentance, I think the Lord will let you go for a bit, let you eat the fruit of your own choices for a while. But because you are the Lord, he will come back and chastise you. And again, he came back and Samson's power was resumed, if it wasn't just for the last time and committing suicide, as it were, and killing all the Philistines. But the point is, there comes a point where God abandons a person. But when you come back to Romans 1, he abandons a society. And that's what Paul is talking about here. God gives them over. He lets them go. You want this, you can have it. And you can deal with the consequences for having it. In other words, he pulls the restraint out. The Greek word here is paradidomai. It's a judicial term God gave them over. It's used of taking a criminal and handing him over for punishment or execution. And you say, well, what's the sentence? Well, that's the sentence. The sentence is let them go. That's the sentence. Let them go. Let them go to the interrupted or uninterrupted course and consequences of their sinful choices. Let them just reap what they sow. Let them eat, as it were, the fruit of their own choices. It's just, again, a pulling back of restraining grace, and God says, you just do what you wanted. You want that? You got it. No more restraining grace. Sin then becomes the cause and the effect. You got that? Sin becomes then both the cause and the effect. It becomes both the reason and the result. It becomes both the root and the fruit. Wrath then, like this, leads sinners to just increasing. That's what I mean. When we see that the wrath of God is upon us today, it just means that God has let us go and man gets worse and worse and worse. It's like putting fuel onto a fire. It keeps just burning and burning out of control. Now, the question, obviously, is how do you get to that point, right? How does society get to a point where then God just lets them go? I mean, if there was a point prior to this that there was restraining grace, even if it's common grace, but then at a point God says, I depart, Ichabod, as it were. How do you get to that point? Well, as it is here in this text, there's six steps. Let me just walk them through with you, just so you understand this. You could say, six steps to the wrath of God. Here's step one, verse 21. This is where it begins. They did not honor him as God or give thanks. We'll call this enmity. It begins with enmity. There's a rejection. There's a suppression of truth. Now, that's in every society, but that's ultimately the first step. There's enmity. And then in verse 22, there's what we might call irrationality. Verse 22, they become futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened, and professing to be wise, they became fools. The word there is literally moronic. They become morons. They become irrational. They can't think. That's step two. Step three is idolatry. Verse 23, and they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Listen, man in religion is not man at his best, it's man at his worst. Do you understand that? So he moves from enmity to rationality to idolatry, and then the next step is in morality. Verse 24, therefore God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. And as I said last week, I've been reading this book, and Bill knows about it, and I would commend it to you. It's really anything by Peter Jones. Does that name ring a bell to some of you? Peter Jones, he's a Brit who has been teaching for years, Brit at Westminster, from I remember, down in San Diego. And his main area of expertise has been watching Western culture become more and more pagan. You know, he calls it the neo-pagan movement, and the words he uses, there's a oneism coming back into the culture. There's always every Western culture that has any Judeo-Christian background has been a two-ism culture, but a pagan culture is a oneism, and that comes from this text. Two-ism is the sense that there's a distinction between the creature and the creator. There's two. There's a male, female. There's a two-ism that the Bible reflects. The pagan mindset, the pagan culture, only sees one. They want to eradicate any distinction. In fact, they themselves are God. There's no longer male and female. There's multiple genders, isn't there? There's no longer binary genders, but non-binary genders. It's all in the water at the moment, right? And this has been building up for years. But what's interesting, and maybe sometime we'll come back and talk about it, but to tie to something like you read here in verse 24, homosexuality, is paganism. It's not just an orientation, but it's a whole other worldview. In fact, I read something this week by a gay homosexual scholar who basically came out and said that. He says, when I realized that I was a homosexual, he admitted he grew up in a church, but when I came to know that I was homosexual, I could no longer think the way that I used to think in terms of a, you know, biblical worldview. I had to go and find another worldview, and I found it in some American Indian shamanism type culture. You go back into ancient history, all the priests were androgynous. There was no real distinction between male and female. They try to blur the lines. That's what paganism is. That's all part of God giving them up to immorality. And again, that's step four. Now, step five, of course, is, when the society is obsessed with sex, when the society is basically a pornographic culture, then the ultimate reflection of their degrading passions, as you can see there in verse 26, is homosexuality. That's step five. You go from enmity to irrationality to idolatry to immorality to homosexuality. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way, also men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. You read that and you say, well, that's our society. Sure it is. And then you tell me we're not under the wrath of God. Well, we're right in the middle of it. We're at step five. And there's one more step, and that's in verse 28, and I call this insanity. Insanity. And look, we over the years have seen the enmity, and we've seen the irrationality, and we've certainly seen the idolatry, and we've seen the immorality, and over the last, 25, 30 or plus years, we've seen the homosexual agenda and the homosexual movement in our faces. And the next step is, well, we've seen this as well, and that's insanity. Verse 28, and just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God, again, gave them over to a what? A depraved mind. You turn on the TV and you hear these politicians and you hear these people and you hear what they say and how they think, and you think, what, are they out of their minds? And the answer is yes. They have a depraved mind. The word depraved mind there has the idea of, it just means useless. It's not functioning as it is to be intended. They don't know what is right. They don't know what is wrong. They do things which are not proper. So, you know, you look at all that, And you understand now why I say that we are under the wrath of God. I mean, when you deconstruct the family, when you deconstruct the society and you redefine marriage, you're asking for God's judgment, aren't you? And that's what we're getting. Let me move on to another thought. That's enough to chew on. But number seven in our little list here. Number seven, we are living in a culture preoccupied, and in fact drowning with pleasure and entertainment. Let me say that again. We are living in a culture preoccupied with pleasure and entertainment. And this is very important to understand, because understanding the culture means you know how to address it, right? If you understand the culture, then you know how to address it, which means, and we all know this, facts don't mean anything anymore. Thinking doesn't mean anything anymore. The only thing that people care about is what? Feelings. Feelings. Feelings are predominant. Feelings rule. Everyone is driven by what makes them feel happy and feel good, whether it's right or wrong. The only interest they have is, does it make me feel good? I mean, as we just read, the mind's gone. Reason's gone. No one thinks anymore. No one uses their mind and thinks logically anymore. I mean, you hear it. I don't care if I was born a male and I have male chromosomes and male genitalia. I feel like I'm a girl. How do we get to this point? I mean, years ago, this stuff used to be where? It used to be in the closet and behind closed doors. It was there. It's always been there. It's always been there, but it's been in the closet behind closed doors. So how did it get to where it is now, where it's on TV and the public discourse, the courts, and even the national government? Well, for starters, you've got Romans 1, as we just went through. You saw it. Degrading passions come when there is a rejection of God, which then leads to an all-out rebellion. But there is another mechanism, which is worth just mentioning. Another mechanism, if you will, of how we got to this point, and that's a cultural shift, if you will, in technology. I think technology, as much as we all love technology, I think technology, for better or for worse, has been for the worse, so to speak. And I know I've mentioned this before. Some of you have heard what I'm about to say, but I think it's worth repeating for all our sake. But I'll just jump into this whole discussion by referring to a book I read years ago and still very, very relevant. The title of the book, just note the title of it, Amusing Ourselves to Death. You remember that, Tony? 30 plus years ago, Neil Postman. Neil Postman was wasn't Christian, I think he was Jewish. He was a sociologist at the University of New York University. And what he did in the book was contrast what he called the age of exposition versus the age of show business. In other words, he said from the dawn of time up into, you know, basically the 20th century, just to put a date on the calendar, we all lived, that is man lived in what's known as a typographical culture. You know what that means? That means that everything newsworthy was put in print. If you wanted information, you would get it via a book, you would get it a newspaper, some kind of written document. With the advent of the camera and then the moving camera, moving pictures, and ultimately the TV, then we moved from a typographical culture to a photographical culture. And so all our information, all our news, as it were, came through that. And by virtue of the photographical culture, by virtue of that type of medium, it became entertainment. And you think about it today. When you watch your evening news, what comes on before the talking hairdo starts talking? And that's what Neil Postman calls them in the book. He calls the news anchors talking hairdos. What comes on? Music, right? Bum, 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 dun, 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 dun. Good evening. Our top story tonight is, And they just go from one story after the other story after the other story after the other story, and then we'll be right back. And it breaks for a Happy Meal commercial or something else, and it comes back. And then there was a bombing in such and such place today, and then there was somebody died over here such and such today, and it bounces around from subject to subject to subject, and it gives you no time to do what? To think about it. It gives you no time to process it, to chew on it. Because in the typographical culture, you could read that. You could stop. You could pause. You could think about it. You could put some rationality to it to see whether it was right or wrong. I mean, I don't think any of you has your remote, and every time the news anchor gives you a story, you pause it to chew over it. No, I doubt that. I'd be very surprised if you did that. Are you understanding why he calls the book Amusing Ourselves to Death? Amusing, A, means what? Not. Musing means thinking. He says not thinking will be the death of us. Again, he's not a Christian, but that's a very biblical thought. You see this in education. I mean, I was raised as a Sesame Street kid, but that's 50 years on now. It's still going on. It's teaching through entertainment, right? We kids just can't sit down and read and write anymore. They have to be entertained, and you can't teach them without entertaining them. And so kids today don't know how to think. And again, in the book, he contrasts this with prior generations. In fact, what's interesting, as I said, he's not a Christian, but what he contrasts it with is George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards of the First Great Awakening. Because he said, it's amazing that in that generation, which was the late 1700s, right? Late 18th century. Here's George Whitefield coming. And he comes to a town, and the people stop whatever they're doing. They come, and they gather, and they assemble, and there's a pulpit place, and he gets up, and he preaches. And people hear, and they chew over what he's saying. Jonathan Edwards, the same thing. You've heard the stories about Jonathan Edwards would write out all his sermons, and he would preach it in somewhat of a monologue just so that people weren't moved by his tone, but moved by the word. He was so concerned that people would not be manipulated in their emotions, but would be thinking correctly. He even uses the Douglas Lincoln debates. Abraham Lincoln and maybe it's not Douglas. Who? Frederick Douglass? I can't remember. Whoever he was running against that year. And as they did back then, they would hop on the train and they would drive into a town. People stopped what they were doing. They go out into the paddock. People pack a picnic, put a blanket out, and they would put one podium here, one podium here, and they would debate each other. They would debate issues. They would debate policies. If I'm president, this is what I will do. If I'm president, this is what I will do. And people would go back and forth and back and forth, and they would chew over this, and so they could be informed. Right? Most people don't even know what their politician stands for. I've told this story before, and I'll bear repeating. I think I told you during Bill Clinton, and Bob Dole was running against it. Bob Dole was a Republican. Clinton was a Democrat. This would have been mid-90s sometime. And I was working at this bank, and during the lunch hour, I was in there, and it was only weeks away from the election, and the subject, there's a bunch of us in there, and the subject of the election came up, and so we were all talking about who we were going to vote, and this woman there, I would say she was in her mid-50s at the time, I asked her who she was going to vote for, and she says, I'm voting for Bill Clinton. And I said, okay, why? Why are you voting for him? Remember I told you the story? Her response, I still can't believe it. She says, because he wears tennis shoes. That's what she said. He wears tennis shoes. Didn't you see him the other day? He came out of the White House in his tennis shoes and he visited the local McDonald's. I mean, he's just like one of us. I love it. Do you know what he stands for? Do you know what his foreign policy is? Do you know what his economic policy is? It doesn't matter as long as he wears tennis shoes and he looks good on a camera. It's even worse to today. It's all about what? Optics, camera, fashion. That's how people vote, isn't it? That's how people think, you know, what's right and what's wrong. They just, it's the mob mentality in one sense, because nobody thinks anymore. As I said, we are living in a culture drowning in pleasure and entertainment. Neil Postman said, the medium is the message. You understand that? Whatever the medium is, that becomes the message. If the medium is entertainment, then the message is going to be what? Entertainment. He says this, let me quote you. When a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. Culture death is a clear possibility, end quote. You know, he's obviously quite prophetic in this. And what he's saying is that when truth becomes trivialized, truth becomes irrelevant. This is where we are in this culture. And now, I'm not saying that, you know, go home tonight and throw your TV out the door, or don't ever watch TV anymore or watch movies, but you need to understand that it has a, well, just by virtue of watching it, it is an unmusing exercise. It's not an exercise of your mind. It's an exercise of your emotion. That's why there's music there when, you know, the hero rides out into the sunset or the two fall in love. Puritans were very helpful in understanding man and basically diagnosing us into three categories. There's the mind, there's the heart, and the will. And they put names to it, the intellectual, the emotional, and the volitional. That's what they described as the spiritual anatomy of man. The intellectual aspect, the emotional aspect, and the volitional aspect. But what's very important as Christians, we need to understand that there's an order to that. Because that is us. We are intellectual people. We are emotional people. We don't want to poo-poo the emotion. And we certainly are volitional. And that is to say there's a mind, there's a heart, and there's a will. Right? Sometimes it's referred to as head, heart, and hands, right? But the point is there's an order there. If you bypass the mind and aim for the heart, as it were, the emotions, in order to act on the will, then you're going to run into problems. And that's where our culture of entertainment comes in. And then, by the way, that's where most of our preaching comes in. Most of the preaching today is not aimed at the mind. It's aimed at the passions to stir you up, to inspire you, right? That's why, you know, our job here is to aim for the mind. Because as a man thinks in his heart, as a man thinks in his mind, so is he, right? As I always say, if you think like Christ, you're going to act like Christ. If you think like Christ, you're going to talk like Christ. But it begins where? It begins in the thinking. It doesn't begin with amusing. It begins with musing. We got to be very careful what we put before our eyes, what we put in our ears, the eye gate, the ear gate, as Bunyan says in Pilgrim's Progress. That's why Solomon says, guard your heart with what? Above all else. For from it, what? Flows the springs of life. You know, on this whole feelings thing, some of you academics would be interested to know. You probably already know it. I'm always late to the game on these things. But I came across an article the other day where this person was saying that your feelings is a contribution to biblical interpretation. In other words, feelings now is part of the hermeneutical process. Now, before it was, you know, let's do the word study, let's do the historical background, let's do the cross-referencing. But now you can add, how do you feel about this text? That's unbelievable. No, maybe not. Maybe it is believable, but that's where we are. The hermeneutics of feelings. But again, I think we've said enough to make the point that we live and are living in a culture preoccupied with pleasure and entertainment, where people are not thinking and they're just feeling, and this is what you get. And as parents, we've got to help our kids. Help our kids to think. The Puritans, you know, before anyone went into Bible college, whatever divinity school they used to call it, the first book they would give them would be Isaac Watts' book on logic, because they believed that if you don't think correctly, then you can't interpret the Bible correctly. And beyond the Bible, if you can't think correctly, you're not going to be any use in society. If you want to be useful in society and make a contribution to society, you need to learn how to think. And as we said, as Christians, we don't know how to think, but society even worse. We need to learn how to think. Do I have time for one more? What time is it? Let me do one more, and then we'll wrap it up, and then we'll pick up where we leave off tonight, next week. But number eight. We are living in the legacy of the self-esteem movement. Again, we're asking the question, how do we get to where we're getting? Well, one reason is that we are living in the legacy of the self-esteem movement. And obviously that's tied to the last point. Listen, when feelings control everything, then your problem is not that... Then your problem is not that you are not thinking right or having a wrong behavior. No, your problem is that you don't feel right about yourself and that you don't love yourself enough. Isn't that what some of you have been told growing up as a kid? What's your problem? Your problem is you just don't have enough self-esteem. You just don't love yourself enough. Again, we're living in the legacy of what I call an over... I think I'm going to say this right, an over-psychologized or over-therapeutic world. We can't discuss man's problem unless we use psychological categories today, which are not biblical. We won't get into it now, but you know my stance on psychology. Psychology is another religion. Psychology is another religion. The doctrine of man is wrong to begin with. Obviously, there's no doctrine of God in there. But doctrine, if you don't have the doctrine of man right, in that you don't diagnose man correctly, then you can't give him the right solution. Christ is all you need. The Bible is all you need. It's sufficient. In other words, let me put it this way. We are watching what happens in a society when everyone gets a trophy. Right? Oh, there's no... I mean, there are winners and losers, but we try to, you know, suppress that a bit. Where everybody's a winner and everybody gets a trophy. I mean, one of my bugbears going out to the kids' sports games is hearing the parents when you know, little Joey strikes out, or when little Joey, you know, drops the ball. Oh, unlucky! You hear that? Unlucky. And I want to say, luck has nothing to do with it. The kid stinks. Right? Has nothing to do with luck. But again, that's the minimizing of all that because of the legacy of the self-esteem movement. When bad behavior is either rewarded or a pill is given to mellow the kid out, to tell him it's not really his fault, that his problem is self-esteem. I mean, what do you get in the end? You get a bunch of what we have today. It's a bunch of what? I think there's a word for it. A bunch of snowflakes, right? A bunch of snowflakes. I mean, even the church has bought into this. I mean, your Hillsongs, your Joel Osteens, all the same kind of programs you see on the quote-unquote Christian television. I mean, don't they all sound alike? Isn't it really pop psychology with a bunch of Bible verses thrown in there just to make it sound like it's Christian? I mean, why is their messages all about how I need to be a better me and how do I make every Friday, every day a Friday? I mean, you hear this, right? It's because their messages are nothing more than, as I said, pop psychology, feel good, self-esteem, positive thinking, motivational speeches that are just laced with a few Bible verses. I mean, I turn it on every once in a while just to tune in, primarily to get sermon illustrations. But, I mean, some of you watch it for the same reasons. I know Frank does, right? When's the last time you heard anyone say anything about sin? There's no mention of sin as the problem. There's no mention of that you must die to self every day. There's no mention of hell, of course, or the wrath of God. Let me give you a quick history lesson on this. Have any of you heard of the name Robert Schuller? Robert Schuller had a church. It's called the Crystal Cathedrals. It's big, gaudy-looking thing in Orange County, just down the road from Los Angeles. And he is really the godfather of all this. He wrote a book in 1982 called The New Reformation. I remember this because just 10 years later, in 1992, when I arrived at the Master's Seminary, it was still a major discussion. You know how some books that come, they just linger around and it becomes a topic that everybody wants to discuss. And I remember we were discussing this, especially in our biblical counseling class. His whole premise was that the church needed a new reformation. I mean, all right, Luther, Calvin had their reformation, but here we are 500 plus years later. We need a whole new reformation. That old reformation is when, with Luther and Calvin, is when we were calling everyone sinners. But Schuller says that was a reactionary movement. Now, he says, times have changed. We know better now because of psychology, and so we need not a reactionary movement, but we need a reconciling movement. That's what he called it, a reconciling movement. In other words, psychology drives the whole argument. Psychology becomes the hermeneutic that reinterprets and redefines everything in scriptures. And it's shocking. Let me give you a few examples. He asked the question, well, what is sin? This is what he says. Sin, again, this is Schuller, quote, becomes any act or thought that robs myself or another human being of his or her self-esteem. That's sin. Elsewhere, he says, quote, the most serious sin is the one that causes me to say, I am unworthy, end quote. He then goes on to say that if you describe or define sin as most catechisms and confessions do, as any want or conformity unto or transgression of the law of God, right? That's biblical. He says if you define it that way, then that is just shallow and insulting to the human being. You can't say that. Now, of course, you would then turn and say, all right, Mr. Schuller, if that's what sin is, then what is salvation? If you're going to redefine sin, I'm sure you're going to redefine salvation, and he does. He says, salvation is no longer represented in terms of propitiation, reconciliation, redemption, and vicarious sacrifice. Rather, he says, salvation, quote, means to be permanently lifted from psychological abuse and shame to self-esteem, end quote. In his words, salvation moves you from a negative thinker to a what? Possibility thinker. That's the term he coined. Be a possibility thinker. Let me give you a few other sound bites. Let your hopes, not your hurts, shape your future. Failure doesn't mean you are a failure. It just means you haven't succeeded yet. Winning starts with beginning. Always look at what you have left. Never look at what you have lost. What appears to be the end of the road may simply be a bend in the road. If you listen to your fears, you will die never knowing what a great person you may have been. Never sell tomorrow short. There's plenty to get excited about. Be filled with expectation, hope, and confidence. Believe something good is going to happen, and it usually will. I'll stop there. Now, if I didn't tell you who said those things, who do you think would have said those things? That sounds exactly what you hear on the Christian channels, doesn't it? It sounds like Joel Osteen. It sounds like Brian Houston and every other guy and gal that you turn the TV on to to watch. I mean, this is why I'm telling you this. You need to understand the influence of psychology and the self-esteem movement in the culture as well as the church today. Of course, what we need to recover, if we really want a new reformation, is what? Well, to begin with, we need to recover the doctrine of sin. I mean, before we can give them the cure, and the cure is the gospel, we need to give the right diagnosis. We need to bring back the Reformation and understand the doctrine of depravity. Karl Menninger, not a Christian, but this is interesting. He was a psychiatrist. This is going back 40, 50, some years ago. I actually don't have the date here, but he wrote a book, and the title of his book, this is interesting. He wrote a book called Whatever Happened to Sin. This is a psychiatrist, not a Christian. And he wrote a book called Whatever Happened to Sin. And the reason why he wrote this book is because he saw the inherent dangers of treating his patients without understanding sin as the root issue. Let me just quote you what he says here. He said, quote, "In all of the laments and reproaches made by our seers and prophets, one misses any mention of sin, a word which used to be a veritable watchword of the prophets. It was a word once in everybody's mind, now rarely, if ever, heard. Does that mean that no sin is involved in all our troubles? Is no one any longer guilty of anything? Guilty, perhaps, of a sin that could be repented and repaired and atoned for? Is it only that someone may be stupid or sick or criminal or recovering or asleep? Wrong things are being done, he writes. We know. Tares are being sowed in what field at night? Is no one responsible? Is no one answerable for these acts? Anxiety and depression, we all acknowledge, and even vague guilt feelings, but has no one committed any sins? Where indeed did sin go? What became of it?" End quote. Again, this is not a Christian, but there's a level of understanding that when you remove sin, you remove any possible helping a person. I mean, today there's just no interest in the public forum in talking about sin, is there? I mean, you will never hear it when you walk through the office of a psychologist, even a quote-unquote Christian psychologist. Whatever happened to sin? This is the mess we're in the moment. This is the mess that we are in at the moment, both in the church and the culture. And you say, how did we get here? Well, we got here because your problem is not sin, it's a lack of self-esteem. No wonder the church is not at salt. No wonder the church isn't light. When I was going through the Sermon on the Mount, we went through the sermon a few years ago. And, the church is light. That's pretty obvious. You know, don't hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. You know, we understand that. But what does it mean that the church is salt? Well, salt back in the times, and still today, it's used as a preservative, used as a season. And so in one sense, you could say that the church is there to preserve a society from it not going as bad as it possibly could. Gives some season to the culture. But it's interesting, when you go back to the Old Testament, there's another function the salt used, and that was to purify things. To put a theological category, it would sanctify things. And I just thought, you know, as a church being the salt of the world, in many respects, that's us. We are the agents, as it were, of purity, of purifying. That is to say, we are the agents by which God uses to see people forgiven, washed, cleansed. No point discussing that if there's no sin, isn't there? Washed from what? Purified from what? So you ask, where are we as a culture? Where is we as a church? Well, this is the legacy of pop psychology and the self-esteem movement. Where people just want to be happy, feel good about themselves. I identify as this. I need my safe place. I mean, you come along now and tell them that they're a sinner, you're going to be branded as what? Oh, hate speech. How dare you? You're insulting me. But that's where we are. But that doesn't change the message, does it? It doesn't change the message. We have to tell people that they're sinners. We have to tell them that they are under the wrath of God. We have to tell them that there's judgment. We have to give them the bad news before we give them the what? The good news. And that's our responsibility. But we can't address the culture unless we understand the culture. And hopefully that has helped. Well, we'll stop there. There's just a few more that I want to get to. And we'll definitely finish next week. But our time's gone for tonight. But as I said, I hope that's helpful. I hope that's just some things to chew on and to think about. And to equip you to do the work of the ministry. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for our time tonight where we can brainstorm, as it were, and think biblically about what's going on in the world. We know just thinking in general is a rare commodity, but thinking biblically is rare as well, but it's a must for us who are Christians. You have told us to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and we want to be obedient to that. We know, Lord, that the Bible says if you're going to get anything, is to get wisdom. And we need wisdom as we move through this world. And the light unto our path is the Word of God. And help us to know the Word of God. And then as we meditate upon it, we know how to apply it to be obedient to you and to be wise and to be able to come alongside and help others. To give us the wisdom we need, give us the illumination we need, give us the discernment that we need, that we may be useful to you, that we may be the salt, that we may be the light that you've called us to be. And we'll thank you in Christ's name. Amen.